This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello and welcome to Beyond the Ballot Box. I'm Dashran Johan. As part of the 12th Malaysia Plan, Prime Minister Ismail Sabri Yaakob recently announced that the sale of Bumiputra shares or companies will only be offered and sold to fellow Bumiputra consortiums, firms and individuals. The announcement received tremendous backlash from opposition MPs and netizens alike. In light of this, on today's show, we're going to be exploring race-based policies in Malaysia. Yay or nay, do they have a role to play or do they just benefit the cronies? So joining me on today's show to help me unpack this is Lee Hock An. He's a senior fellow with the Malaysian Studies Program at the ICS Yusof Ishak Institute. Welcome to the show, Hock An. How are you doing?
Hi, Dashran. Good to be with you. I'm doing well. Thanks.
All right. So the 12th Malaysia Plan, Hock An, what are your overall thoughts on it? Specifically with regard to race-based policies, what were your hopes and expectations prior to the announcement and were they met?
Well, I had written some of my thoughts about that prior to that. And I think you could call that a very naive hope about how there could be a transition from race-based to identity-based in terms of the sort of the overarching framework and get away from, you know, a very polarized and stalemated and antagonistic debate, an unproductive one where it's like defending race-based and then just opposing it and not really presenting alternatives. Of course, I wasn't really expecting that change to take place, and that proved true. A context, right? It's important. I mean, how far you want to go back, you can go back 50 years. But I think we start with about 10 years ago. There's a lot of continuity. So that's the first thing that stands out in terms of the, you know, this is an enduring and very embedded agenda. From the 11th Malaysia Plan, you can already begin to see some of the certain structure taking place in which there is clarity. So I think some positive here in the sense of clarity in what the agenda stands for in terms of how it its various institutions that are involved and the programs that are being implemented. And as well, you know, there's more structure into the outreach for the other communities, for Orang Asli, for Indians, for, you know, East Malaysia states and the Bumiputra population there, for women. But it's still, you know, presented in a way that, yeah, the Bumiputra agenda really takes primacy and there's a bit more, you know, tokenism for the others. And I just wish that, you know, they could be seen as part of, systemically, we could view them, right, as serving a same set of national objectives targeting, you know, different groups. I do want to add that, you know, that one interesting aspect of the 12th plan and the speech is that, you know, this is such a grandest you know, national blueprint, sort of the grandest, you know, policy speech, and it is taken from a 530-page document, right, which has a very clear outline, you know, of chapters and what do they call them, themes and game changers and, right, and all that. But this year is a very, you know, peculiar circumstances. There's only 1 month between Ismail Sabri becoming prime minister and then launching it. And so you wonder, right, how is the document is done. And so you can see that he's trying to make an imprint on it by inserting some references to Keluarga Malaysia. Mm-hmm. And also you find that these 9 points of focus in the speech, you know, it departs from the structure actually of the outline of the 12th Malaysia Plan. Maybe a note of caution, you know, a note just to be more circumspect that the speech I see as being a little bit more of political elements this time around because of these political circumstances, a report that's essentially done and then a new prime minister that wants to, you know, make a difference to it, sort of restructuring it with nine points instead of the 13 chapters, and then giving a lot more prominence, especially to the issue of the Bumiputra agenda, then I think is warranted based on the plan. I mean, and on that note, I think it's also notable and a bit unfortunate that the chapters towards the end on the issues of, you know, sustainability and climate, you know, get quite short shrift. I think we need to also not be too driven and not be reactive to the speech making and to the ways that this is being politicized. For example, it talks about the median income gap. One way to justify the continuation of the program, besides the equity issue, which I think we'll come to, is this statement about the median income gap between Bumiputra and Chinese is widening, quadrupling in 2019 compared with the gap in 1989. This is really quite misleading. It's giving the impression that the disparity is growing. And if I could just unpack that a little bit, I think it helps with a few numbers. So we're talking about 1989 and 2019. I'm going to round up the numbers here, but this is referring to the average household income. So in 1989, let's just use these rounding numbers. Bumiputra was about 1,000 ringgit and Chinese about 2,000. So what's the difference there? It's 1,000, right? Mm-hmm. We're talking about the absolute gap in terms of how many ringgit. In 2019, it's 7,000 for Bumiputra and 10,000 for Chinese. Okay, so the gap, just the absolute numbers go from 1,000 to 3,000. And this is what it's trying, this is what the statement is saying, that right. gap has quadrupled three times. But what has happened to the income growth of the two communities? Chinese went from 2,000 to 10,000, five times increase. Bumiputra went from 1,000 to 7,000, seven times increase, right? And the ratio has narrowed. So it's really quite misleading there. And I think that kind of, that appeared in the speech as well, and sort of as a premise then to launch into promoting the agenda, I think is unfortunate and unnecessary and a bit and quite misleading. I think the Bumiputra agenda can be justified, but it should be on grounds that are a little bit more objective, you know, that are more systematic.
Right. Now, before we circle back to the 12th Malaysia Plan, I think it's important to take a step back and look at this topic from a broader context first. Hockman, are race-based policies important and necessary in Malaysia? Because something else you've been a critic of for the longest time is, you know, in fact, sometimes when I read your articles, your frustration seems almost palpable, right? Is this whole idea of race-based policies versus needs-based policies. You do not like this debate at all. As someone who studies economic policies closely, what exactly is it about this debate that annoys you?
Yeah, what? Well, I'm glad you detected that frustration. I guess it's hard to hide it. What frustrates me is, you know, that it just goes back and forth, in talking past each other on both sides of this debate, essentially because they are not alternatives, they are not contradicting, both operate, both are important, both are necessary, and we should be focusing on how to implement both the need-based and the race-based, which I am proposing we move away from to broaden that to be identity-based. And broadening here doesn't mean that we make it more vast and expansive, but that we address these set of policies, you know, that are group targeted, you know, not exclusively for one, but for the various targeted groups that are already in the whole, you know, planning mainstream. Right, they have been in the 11th Malaysia Plan, and now as well in the 12th Malaysia Plan. But to unpack that a little bit, right? I think we come back to the basics, that why both are necessary and important and have their specific role and limits as well. So when we say need-based, which actually the language has sort of vanished from the 12th Malaysia Plan, although it was still in the 11th Plan, but this, you know, would concur, right, would be aligned with the there were the kind of set of policies that target B40 and address poverty. So, you know, the agenda for poverty reduction remains. And I think this is addressing mainly that when we say need-based policies. So it's still that objective, right, of meeting basic needs, of reducing poverty, of providing basic schooling, infrastructure, rural development. Another important element is the how they operate. Right, and this feature of universal provision. And so the list that I had just gave, right, essentially they are provided on a universal basis, not necessarily targeting a particular group, but for any member of society. Now, not everybody will need it, but still everybody is entitled to it. Not everybody will need, to receive cash transfers, but everybody is still entitled to it. And the same for minimum wage. The other element is that there's equality, right? The amounts you could, in some cases, are also equal, but the principle of equality comes into the picture here. And I think that is sorely lacking, because I think if we want to give an assurance, right, government, for sort of for the policies, which I think there is that intent in declaring, since the new economic policy, especially, that helping all groups, right, reducing poverty, regardless of race, you know, that is still ringing today. We still cling to that as the assurance, sort of a code to say that the system looks out for all Malaysians. But I think that is just really, woefully lacking, that we should still be, parroting that help the poor regardless of race. We should really go towards, shift towards something that is broader and richer, that, provide for guarantee equality and rights, right, in universal provision, regardless of identity, not just regardless of race. And these are also areas where there are very zero or minimal barriers to entry. So practically, you can do it on the basis of just, universal provision. I think one contrast, or one aspect that can bring up the contrast between these need-based and the identity-based is in schooling. So basic schooling, primary schooling, is something that can be provided for all universally, not just because, of course, yes, firstly, because it is a right, it is even compulsory, but also it can be done. There are no entry requirements and all that. So the policy is basically about providing for all, right? And you don't need to get, have any other means of selection. It's a general syllabus. So now the other major realm or a domain of policies related to that are group targeted, that also involve some element of targeting a group, and often some amount of preferential treatment to increase the participation of that group in particular areas. Okay, so this is what I'm going to term now identity-based policies that are promoting participation of the identified group in specific areas.
I think this ties into something you wrote in the article that I picked out. So this article you wrote recently is on Fulcrum, and it's titled Transforming Malaysia's Elephant in the Room, Conflict, Consensus, or Cop-Out. And in one part you wrote, and I quote, Pakatan Harapan often entangle themselves in contradictions by advocating policies that target minority groups and women, while essentially, pushing back against policies that target Bumi Putras. Hokan, why do you find this a contradiction? Because I think there is an argument to be made that, for example, women, let's say ethnic Indians, for example, the OKU community, etc., they are minorities in the country, whereas, let's say, Malays are the majority in the country.
Yeah, I think you are right in that probably is the one basis that you could say it is more, you know, valid. And some would argue that, yes, it can only be done for, you know, minorities, but not majority. I don't subscribe to that view. And Malaysia is not the only country where there is a disadvantaged majority. Mm-hmm. I'm talking here about the conditions that gave rise to the policy in the first place. And you look at, you know, post-apartheid South Africa and the case in Namibia and Fiji, some of the other examples, where it's really, that's why I come back to the objective of this domain of policies and how they operate. And so if it's a country set in a situation in which a group, right, is majority or minority, and whether it's by race or caste or gender, is underrepresented, that means they have lacking access and participation in higher education, in certain occupations, in enterprise, like in business, right, managing and owning business and assets and property more broadly. This is a situation, you know, that countries have found it calls for special measures going beyond just helping the poor, because even if you help the poor, if those inequalities can persist, the specific inequality, right, of a group, you know, not having very, very few of them in universities, very few in professional and management positions and owning and running businesses. It's inadequate to just say also, equality will treat everyone equally, only look at qualifications. Well, if you in that is one option, but that kind of change is going to happen very, very slowly, right? And there could be other factors that also inhibit the change that are structural and historic, because there's a lot more that has to be overcome. So as I said just now, the contrast with the policies that are more need-based, in which there are no barriers or very minimal barriers to entry, you just provide the schooling and everyone can go to school. You cannot just say set up a university and then say, you know, everyone is able to get in. The positions are fewer, right? It's more specialized, and there are barriers to entry in the form of, well, the entry requirements, because you do have to meet certain standards to enter university. Even if you want to relax it to some extent to promote, you know, a particular group to enter a university and have a more diverse student body. So I think if we look at it in this way, in a more coherent and systematic way, it's not a question of whether it's majority group or a minority group. And I think this is why it is really, you know, lacking that on the part of Pakatan Harapan and more broadly, I think in Malaysian society, to have to still cleave to this need base, right, as an alternative to race based in a very general sense. I'm not dismissing it entirely. I think, you know, there is a moral basis to say that we should act on, you know, do policies on the basis of need instead of race, but we need to apply it more in a ways that are more focused and specific. See, the underlying logic behind this view that do need based instead of race based is that people agree with the objectives still of, you know, having a Bumiputra middle class, of Bumiputra's, you know, vibrant businesses and so on, but then. And so to say that, look, we can achieve the same outcome of Bumiputra business, more of them participating there, by just helping the poor. Because if you help the poor and Bumiputras are the majority of the low income, you eventually help the community. Mm-hmm. So firstly, that's helping the poor, which achieves poverty alleviation, not so much upward mobility. And, you know, helping the poor is not just going to suddenly, you know, you groom these, you know, entrepreneurs and professionals and a middle class. But, you know, we don't apply that illogic, right? That kind of argumentation to anything else, right? So, you know, notice, no one will say that female-headed households are disproportionately higher among poor households. So let's not target women. Let's only target the poor, and women eventually will benefit because, you know, female-headed households right. are the majority. No one will say, let's stop doing Sabah-targeted policies or Sarawak-targeted policies on the basis that, well, you know, the majority of the poor or the poverty rate in Sabah is higher. So if we just target the poor, then Sabah is going to, you know, is going to reap the benefits anyway, right? Mm-hmm. We only apply this logic when it comes to race. And that's just doesn't cut it. You know, we cannot take, you know, logical leaps and these missteps because we're uncomfortable to talk about the issue. The second one about the contradiction is that, well, look at the trajectory of Pakatan Harapan. Look at Buku Harapan. I'm quoting from Buku Harapan, Pakatan Harapan's manifesto in 2018. Pakatan mm-hmm. Harapan government will give particular attention to the economic development of the Malays and Bumiputra so that they will become a group that can stand tall when competing globally. GLCs will be instructed to galvanize efforts to increase Bumiputra equity holding in the country. Pakatan Harapan's manifesto from 2018. They were proposing more something of management buyout. So the spirit is there, right? You know, when it comes to actually governing and wanting to, you know, have a policy plan for the whole country, you will be confronted with the reality that these things need to be addressed and that you can't just, you know, sweep them away. I mean, it's really so telling that there was such a lot in the Buku Harapan that was addressing Bumiputra development.
On the show with me today is Lee Hock An. He's a senior fellow with the Malaysian Studies program at the ICS Yusof Ishak Institute. After the break, I'll be asking him if it's not so much so important to get rid of race-based policies, for example, pro-Bumi policies, but rather focus on strengthening policies aimed at other groups. We'll be back with more on Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Beyond the Ballot Box. I'm Dashran Johan, and on the show with me today is Lee Hock An. He's a senior fellow with the Malaysian Studies program at the ICS Yusof Ishak Institute. And we're talking about race-based policies, yay or nay. So, Hock An, one of the other things that stood out to me about your article is the part where you wrote that race-based policies cannot drastically balloon or roll back as governments come and go. Why do you say so? Because I think that seems to be one of the worries among the electorate on both sides of the aisle. The idea that if we have a conservative, race-based, perhaps nationalistic government, that these policies will indeed balloon exponentially and perhaps that will lead to our fundamental liberties being affected as well and all of these things. But on the other side, people also worry that if we have a progressive multiracial government, then, for example, the new economic policy will just be abolished and you know, if we will leave the majority of the poor people, which are Bumiputras, you know, to just suffer. That is the fear that people have. But you say, regardless of which government come and go, we're not going to see such a drastic shift. Why do you say so?
Well, firstly, because there is actually not that much disagreement in the policy front on these issues. I mean, when it would, you know, the rhetoric aside, there is the policies, right, are so, and the programs are so deeply embedded. And so it's, you know, new governments come in, you know, are not in any do not have the capacity to make drastic changes. Also because, you know, they would affect real livelihoods and access to opportunity. So there is that practical element as well. And I think, you know, again, coming back to what I said just now, you know, with Pakatan Harapan, you know, in opposition and in government. I think in government, you just steer towards being more practical and having to be more responsive to all sides. What I say is, you know, not ballooning, right, is key. So it's I don't see that there's drastic expansion. Of course, there can be and there will be some modification. I think, again, if we are, you know, a bit more, take a more sober look at the speech, right, which was also a little bit of the Prime Minister's speech. I think there were elements there that were, you know, speaking to the gallery and also kind of baiting for a response by, you know, making, I think, things a bit larger than they actually are. If, you know, looking at the policy itself, I mean, I think we need to be vigilant, yes, you know, about the implementation, about what might happen. But again, there, you know, it's a lot of things there that are really either a continuity, you know, or more of a slight tweak. And we saw with Pakatan Harapan that it's not going to drastically roll back as well, especially if you don't think in terms of some policy specifics that can be that are coherent and that are also strategic. So as an example, one of the these Bumiputra mandated institutions is one called Yayasan Penaraju Pendidikan. Now it actually has a even more specific mandate to reach out to young people for tertiary, you know, especially technical education, who come from difficult, disadvantaged, and challenging backgrounds. And it's a more newly established one. I think it's worth opening the conversation on this particular Yayasan Penaraju, whether it can be opened up in the same way that you had microfinance institution Tekun opened up one scheme for the Indian community. You have Amanah Saham Bumiputra, and then you also have, you know, Amanah Saham other schemes that are more open. So there are precedents for programs that have started out as exclusively Bumiputra, but then open up. It's a really a question of are we interested to actually look in the specifics? Are we interested in, you know, and bothered to try and find solutions in a specific way rather than making sweeping statements? I mean, I think you want to look at some that have less baggage, that are, you know, something like Yayasan Penaraju, and then really just make the case, because again, it is intervening in a space that is not principally about just giving money to the poor and helping those who are struggling. This is about upward mobility, targeting, right? People, yes, from disadvantaged backgrounds, but it is for the purpose of higher education. So it has to be approached in that way, you know, that they still will need to clear a certain bar in terms of academic achievement in order to get into these technical programs under Yayasan Penaraju. But it's just, you know, so ripe for an opportunity to demonstrate. I think Malaysia is in need of showing this can happen, showing that something that was a very racially exclusive can be broadened up to all communities, right? But we're not going to get there, you know, unless we actually delve into certain specifics and look at the actual programs and not get too carried away, right, with a lot of this rhetoric and the fear of menacing kind of agenda and a gigantic increase. I think there are checks in place that it's not going to happen within a very fluid, you know, the political system that we talk about as well. I don't think you can see a repeat of the kind of things that took place like in the 1990s with privatization. You know, I mean, there should be a concern still and a vigilance about any the issues of divestment and so on. But, you know, I don't see a repeat there as well, because the political and situation and global economic conditions are also very different.
Just to be clear about something, Hock, and what you're essentially saying, right? And I think this is perhaps has been your argument for quite some time. You can correct me if I'm wrong, is that yes, broad, you know, needs-based policies are important as well, but race-based policies can be equally important, but the solution shouldn't be in Malaysia to eradicate pro-Bumi policies out of this fear because of the rhetoric and the baggage and all of that, but instead focus on strengthening non-boomy policies. Would that be a fair assessment of your argument?
Okay, so I would come back again, right? What is mm-hmm. the purpose and what is the scope of some of these policies? When we talk about group targeted policies, right? Mm-hmm. You know, principally, they're about promoting participation, about promoting achievement. Okay, so not about meeting basic needs. Meeting basic needs are a separate set, and they're actually, I would say, even more important. There's a greater moral obligation, and financing should more go there. But that doesn't mean that you can do away with these group-targeted policies. Now, we readily accept that some of these are good, right? We cannot, but I don't think we should just say that it's good only if it benefits a minority. It is, you know, unacceptable if it benefits the majority. I think it's much better and constructive to recognize what it is trying to achieve and then find the space for it to be more inclusive, right? I think we need to move forward, right, towards thinking in terms of a domain of policies that are trying to promote achievement, through, especially in higher education, in SME development, all right? Especially these two, because these are much more productive oriented, not so much about acquiring wealth, right? Mm. If you have a very, very strict meritocracy, right, in a purest sense, then, well, you know, you may be true to that, but the effect could be you exclude certain groups.
You mentioned wealth accumulation and wealth ownership and that, you know, we should stop obsessing ourselves over that. This then brings me to the latest proposed Bumiputra equity policy in the 12th Malaysia Plan, which has certainly stirred the pot in recent days, as we mentioned in the introduction. Perhaps you can break down why exactly this proposed policy is so controversial, because I remember you and Iskandar Faris in our discussion about the new economic policy, you also mentioned that this idea of, you know, just being so fixated on equity ownership is the reason why, you know, a lot of these rhetorics are stemmed from, is the reason why a lot of people, you know, get angry at each other and get worried and all of that, because it's a very sort of skewed way of looking at things, but yet that is how everybody looks at things. It's the idea of equity ownership. Perhaps you can talk to me a little bit about this.
Yeah, well, there's a long history to this. And I think some of my even ongoing research, you know, has seen that in the early 70s, initially the new economic policy, its ultimate objective was expressed regarding, you know, this in NEPs, they call it the second prong, basically this affirmative action and group targeted Bumiputra policies. The ultimate objective was for full economic partnership, right? That the Bumiputras will be full partners in the economic life of the nation. By the mid 70s, you know, that ultimate objective really starts to narrow down, and that the fixation with 30% Bumiputra equity ownership, you know, really becomes very anchored, and it has, you know, been a real practically a policy driver for sure, but it's also kind of been this, you know, a shorthand. It's sort of the code for, you know, continuing the Bumiputra policy. And I think that it's been unfortunate because it detracts from more important, in my view, policy priorities that are dealing with developing capability, you know, and competitiveness and confidence through higher education, through enterprise development, especially, again, because these are principally, you know, active and productive engagements in learning and in doing, in actually running a business. Whereas we have a long, you know, there's a lot of baggage. And I think sometimes it's maybe a bit overblown, or we are, you know, hanging on to that baggage and not letting go of it as well. But certainly there has been a baggage where the forcible, right, or a redistribution of equity by law was done in the 70s and into the 80s, you know, in initial public offerings and then equity requirements, usually around 30%. But actually, a lot of it has been scaled back. So that's why I'm just also thinking that, you know, I don't know if we, yeah, I wonder, sometimes it's a bit overblown in the sense that we still also focus on it from a critical perspective. So I guess this is more of a non-Malay view, you could say in general, to harp on it as well, right? Mm-hmm. When actually it's one of the areas in which there has been rollbacks. It's not been at that scale that it was before. I think the fear that it may come back is a legitimate one. I think there has to be a lot of vigilance about that. But what I'm getting at is, you know, the, I think the different programs that are being proposed, you know, need a different sort of analysis. If there's going to be an issue of divestment of GLCs, right? So GLCs, you know, if there are plans for that, well, GLCs are national institutions. I think the case can be made much more strongly there that it needs to be a process that is involves national participation, involving all groups and not just only a Bumiputra agenda, right? That's GLCs. Mm. Now, there's another set that is related to equity holdings currently held by Bumiputra mandated agencies, right? PUNB or MARA, right? And so they are currently serving a Bumiputra agenda. So the case whether those should be transferred, there should be intervention to transfer them strictly only to Bumiputra, well, I mean, it can be argued, but that's different from GLCs, right? Mm-hmm. Because GLCs are national. These are already currently designated for a Bumiputra community. I mean, there can be a much bigger debate about that, but the main point is that we really need to move away from the sweeping statements, right, that will just either lambaste the whole thing or just embrace the whole thing, both ways. And then this other one that's gotten a lot of attention also is equity safety net. Mm. It's the wording of the 12th plan is the possibility of establishing it. It's a radical idea. I mean, they'd like to talk about radical, you know, in the plan here. And I think this is one that, yeah, that is raising a lot of concern. You know, but I think the critique here should also be that it could be just really a really bad idea, right? Practically, because if you only restrict it to, you limit the market of buyers, then the price, right? And the range, right, the pool of potential investors is going to be limited. And in the first place, if it's a question of selling, well, what if, you know, it's a failing company or it's a sunset industry? Then why would you force, you know, why would you require then that Bumiputra investors will have to take over, right? So I think there's not very much to react to yet, except, you know, to say that it's still a possibility. I think it's, you know, it's something, you know, that could be, you know, quite problematic. We need to keep an eye on it, but it needs a different kind of reaction again than the an analysis than the issue of GLC divestment and also of divestment of Bumiputra, you know, ownership under Bumiputra agencies.
Do you agree with the core of YB Syed Saddiq's argument in Parliament? He said like he doesn't have a problem with policies that will help the Bumiputra community. But what he suggests is, you know, focusing on capacity building, helping small businesses, what are their needs? How can they grow? What kind of training can we give all these small businesses so that they can become bigger? Schools for children, we talk about, you know, the internet access and all these kinds of things compared to when we talk about equity policies where, you know, companies can be bought by certain groups and cannot be bought by certain groups and all of that. He said, fundamentally, the only people that it will benefit are the people that already have everything, the people who are rich. You know, so in this context, because it's a Bumi policy, then it will benefit the rich Malays, for example, perhaps the certain cronies and politicians and all these huge businesses. And he also brought up another point about how at the end of the day, by doing this, what you're also doing is reducing opportunities for non-Bumis in Malaysia and instead giving it to foreigners as well. This is extremely unfair. What are your thoughts on his argument?
Yeah, I mean, in principle, I think, you know, I would concur with that. What drives the policy here, you know, should be about capacity building with more focus on, you know, small and medium enterprises, and less on just, you know, wealth transfers. But I think sometimes the characterization, you know, of a, you know, and it's in just stigmatizing, right, any kind of intervention that has this Boyputra element as just about being politically connected and cronies, right, is not true, and you know, to and can be quite unhelpful. I mean, very recent research I did on the issue of you know, procurement, right, of Bumiputra contractors, mm-hmm. and it's one of those things also that that can be just, yeah, you know, just dismissed, right, and tarred all with this with one brush. Oh, this is you know, it's just all politically connected people and the problem of cronies. I mean, really, it's so much more complex and nuanced and multifaceted than that. You know, we spoke in my own research to, you know, to just to really, you know, decent and genuine people who Bumiputra, young entrepreneurs who want to do, you know, start a business, right, and do work, mm-hmm. and not just, you know, accumulate, you know, contracts and engage in those problematic areas. Those problematic areas definitely are you know, concerns that we have to address. But you know, I think the starting point, right, what should be driving the discourse, is, you know, what is the ultimate purpose here, right? And I think, yes, you know, there is some consistency there. I mean, if you looking back at, you know, Buku Harapan and Pakatan Harapan, the consistency of more focus, right, on enterprise development rather than wealth transfers. But, you know, yeah, I just wish that we could not always be so reflexive, and you know see certain policies and it's really baited as well, and you bite mm-hmm. it, right, you take the bait, because you know this kind of a bit of a chest thumping element of this speech. So focus on what could be the alternatives. If the fear is that yes, it could benefit just the elites, well, I mean, either reject it entirely or say that, look, put in place mechanisms to ensure that you know, that there is some check against that, or even maybe, you know, go a bit more creative and say, you know, and consider, well, maybe they, if a situation of that divestment, they need to be looking into whether the employees should be getting some shares, right? And that's one way to, you know, to make it a bit more, you know, broadly spread, right, rather than just, yeah, you know, banging the drum of being against it and then referencing pro-poor policies.
All right, as we wrap this conversation up, Hock An, final thoughts, yay or nay to race-based policies?
Malaysia needs to move from thinking about narrowly race-based to identity-based and coherently and systematically, you know, look at how these type of policies can be more effective, more equitable in targeting Bumiputra, in Indian Orang Asli, women and other categories in the specific areas to promote, right, participation and achievement.
On that note, Hock An, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Dashan.
That was Lee Hock An. He's a senior fellow with the Malaysian Studies Program at the ICS Yusof Ishak Institute. If you missed any part of our conversation, do check us out on podcasts. We are Beyond the Ballot Box. You can find us on the BFM app, BFM.my, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or pretty much wherever you get your podcasts from. I'm Dashran Johan, and this has been Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.